Hello, listener, and welcome to yet another episode of The Zeitgeist Tapes, a podcast in which me, Stephen Fielding, and my colleague Emma Burnell, say hello, Emma.
Hello.
Discuss an item of cultural life and think about its political implications, which sounds terribly dull now I've put it like that. But actually, hopefully...
Don't switch off, listener.
That it might sound dull, but hopefully produces an engaging conversation about something you might have watched or listened to or read or might not have, and it might encourage you to watch, listen, or read. So in this episode, we are going to talk about the novel, the Julian Barnes novel, England, England, which was first published in 1998. And I don't know how many Julian Barnes fans are out there and whether our listener is one of them and whether they've read the novel. But it was when Emma suggested that we might want to discuss it, it was news to me. I've never read a Julian Barnes novel. I've been aware of the existence of Julian Barnes, but never quite got round to reading anything he's written. And I'd never heard of the novel England, England. So I just wonder why, Emma, we should be discussing a novel written in 1998 in 2019.
So this was recommended to me, and in fact lent to me, by a really good friend of mine called Karen Robinson, whose wonderful podcast, Primarily 2020, all about the Democratic primaries, I'm a frequent guest on. And Karen is American, but lives here. And she read this book when it first came out, and then she reread it last year. And she was just absolutely bowled over by how many parallels there were with Brexit. And how much of the narrative way back in 1998 was still being set then, about this sort of backward looking nostalgia for a type of England that never really existed. Shall I sort of outlay the themes of the book?
Well, yeah, just very briefly, just tell us what it's about, even though, you know, there may be some spoiler alerts, but tough.
Well, as you know, we always give spoilers on this show. Yeah. If you haven't, do your homework, listeners. That's what we ask of you. So basically, England, England is about a fairly rapacious businessman. He's a sort of a cross between Richard Branson and Nigel Farage, essentially. He's got all the ridiculous accoutrements of a cartoon Englishman. You can probably hear the air quotes there. But he's also just a, out and out rapacious capitalist. And he decides to set up a theme park based on England and buys the Isle of Wight to do it and sets himself up as the governor of the Isle of Wight and has the Isle of Wight Parliament first secede from UK mainland so that they're independent and then elect him governor with all powers. Which, of course, he promises beforehand he will never exercise and then becomes a dictator. And the theme park is so successful that all of the money flows out of mainland UK and flows into England, England, which is this, all of the tourist money goes there and old England falls apart and new England, England and England, as it were, becomes the main country. The royal family move there.
Manchester United even move there, don't they?
Manchester United move there. All the things, they have this list of the 50 most culturally important sort of things that people think about when they think England. And they make sure that they're all there, including the real royal family, Manchester United, Robin Hood, who, of course, goes rogue. and yeah, it's an absolute, the little Englandness of it is encapsulated so perfectly. And for me, it was fascinating that it was written in 1998, well before Brexit. The referendum party was on the horizon, but they weren't really, they were embarrassing themselves in David Miller's count. That was the most that we knew of them.
So it's but 1998 is kind of
it was the height of Cool Britannia.
Well, yeah. Although he clearly had Julian Barnes formulated in his head sometime in the 1990s, but before maybe Tony Blair talked about creating Britain into a young country, which is kind of the opposite of what the novel's about. So that's kind of an interesting contrast we might want to talk about on whatever happened to the young country. But yeah, he was writing at a time, I think, when the kind of UKIP-y sentiment was politically forming, you know, with the referendum party. But also it was the time when people were just talking about Britain as a heritage kind of park, theme park, as a country, that it had a past, it had traditions, but did it have a future? I think a lot of people are asking. But I just wonder if it'd be useful just to read out a short excerpt. I mean, we normally have it more in the middle, but I think it might be useful just to give our listener an idea of what the island was, what it became, its kind of character. So this is actually from fairly late on in the novel, after the island, the Isle of Wight, which is now just called the island, has now become the what Sir Jack Pittman, who is this kind of monstrous entrepreneur, has created in not quite his own image, but his image of what he thinks Britain is. And his company, Pitco, is basically running it as a kind of free market heritage theme park. So this is just a description of it. And this is me reading it. So you have to forgive any kind of lapses on my part. Everything on the island worked because complications were not allowed to arise. The structures were simple, and the underlying principle of action was that you did things by doing them. So there was no crime, and therefore no judicial system, and no prisons, at least not real ones. There was no government, only a disenfranchised governor, and therefore no elections and no politicians. There were no lawyers except Pitco lawyers. There were no economists except Pitco economists. There was no history except Pitco history. Who could have guessed back there in Pittman House as they stared at the map laid out on the battle table what they would stumble into creating? A locus of uncluttered supply and demand. Somewhere to gladden the heart of Adam Smith. Wealth was created in a peaceable kingdom. What more could anyone want, be they philosopher or citizen? Perhaps it really was a peaceable kingdom, a new kind of state, a blueprint for the future. If the World Bank and the IMF thought so, why deny your own publicity? Electronic as well as retro readers of the Times discovered immaculately good news about the island, mixed news about the wider world, and unremittingly negative news about old England. By all accounts, the place had been in a state of freefall, had become an economic and moral waste pit, perversely rejecting the established truths of the third millennium. Its diminishing population knew only inefficiency, poverty, and sin. Depression and envy were apparently their primary emotions. Whereas on the island, a bright and modern patriotism had swiftly evolved, not one based on tales of conquest and sentimental recitations, but one which, as Sir Jack might have put it, was here, was now, and was magic. So that kind of sets out how the island had developed and what had happened to old England, to real England. So real England is, and we're saying, it's kind of been replaced in many people's minds by its replica, its idealized replica, at least an idealized replica based on, you know, snatches of history, which have been manufactured, which have been distorted, which have been created to become more acceptable to the modern world. The novel is kind of set a few decades hence from 1998, so maybe in our own times, in some ways. So, and obviously you can hear what's happened to the real England. It's gone into a significant decline, which is described more fully towards the end of the novel.
But also that decline is stoked by the reporting of it by the Times, which is bought wholesale and imported into the island. So it's one of the things about this is the use of propaganda.
Mm. Oh, yes. I mean, everything is, well, there's a whole thing in the novel about what is authentic. Can anything be authentic? I mean, Sir Jack Pittman, who's like, you know, this horrible entrepreneur who is, I mean, he's an amalgam of all of them of the time. It's not just Richard Branson. It's also Murdoch. It's also, he was a horrible man that owns the Times. Maxwell, you know, so he owns lots of newspapers, media, as well as companies, and he's basically a fraudster in many ways. It's not even clear what is his nationality. I mean, who is he? It's not even clear. He might not be even British. Not that you know, he might be from Europe somewhere. So he's got a very shady kind of background, but he asserts himself in these patriotic ways. So it's about that, but it's also and about the nation, but it's also about the individual Martha Cochrane. I mean, she's basically the only really significant character other than Sir Jack, who we are shown at the start of the novel. She kind of grows up in this village, has all these memories, but it's not entirely clear, you know, who is she? Does she, you know, what's her identity? Does she know what her identity is? Who is the authentic Martha? And it kind of then widens out as to being, well, what is England? And because it isn't about Scotland, and Wales comes into it, but only in a comic way. What is England? What is English history? And it just asks questions about who are we? How do we know who we are and who we believe ourselves to be? And how our own history has been, to an extent, made up and shaped.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really, I mean, I think the use of Robin Hood is very deliberate, because Robin Hood is a myth, but it's a myth based on three or four different stories that we sort of think are real but aren't really, and we kind of plug them all together and turn them into the Alan Rickman, Kevin Costner film, in the same way that Scotland's done with Braveheart.
Yeah,
we've mythologized our own myths. And I think, you know, the fact that Robin Hood is so inauthentic in terms of what actually happened, which in itself is, as I understand it, quite contested.
Yeah.
And the massive myth building on top of that. I think that was a very deliberate choice to have that as part of the English myth, because it is a myth of a myth.
Mm.
And I think, you know, as well as some of the other sort of real symbolic things that they come up with, that one of which they completely make up out of whole cloth, which is the Heavens to Betsy caricature, which is becomes their logo. This again is based on a very not true myth about a woman who fell off a cliff, but whose skirts billowed so much that she floated gently to the ground, carrying and not even breaking her eggs.
Yes, and she also had an early umbrella, which also was like a parachute. Now, the interesting thing about that is, I mean, I don't know whether it's that interesting. I was on the Clifton Suspension Bridge a year or two ago, and there was a man who claimed to be a guide to that. And he told the exact same story.
No.
Yeah, yes. That there was, you know, apparently sometime in the 19th century, there was a woman who fell off and...
Well, maybe that's got it from.
Well, maybe, I don't know, but it kind of reinforces the point that this is a novel, but it's based on actual, you know, real myths,
the real version of
mythology. That kind of just makes that point. Yeah, when I was reading that, I was like, that happened at the Clifton Suspension Bridge. It didn't happen wherever it was meant to happen. But the interesting thing about that is that one of the minor characters is a historian. A television historian, Dr. Max, who, I mean, I'm a historian and I can recognise that character, a kind of a parody.
Can I say you're nowhere near as pompous as Dr. Max?
sure, yeah, perhaps not. I don't wear waistcoat.
For a start.
But it's Dr. Max who comes up with this this story, and he's kind of, he's quite a very cynical character. He's, you know, professional historian. He's very cynical and blithe about the manipulation of the past, because he's actually their historical consultant, isn't it? The whole project's historical consultant.
Yeah.
And given it's a complete travesty, although of course the question of the novel is what isn't a travesty about how we think about ourselves, makes it kind of ironic, I suppose, or doubly so, that an actual historian is fully on board.
Yeah.
But as I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that, as someone who deals with history, and I'm aware of the huge and vast degree of ignorance about our country's past and the very stereotypical ways in which people do think about it, rang completely true. You know, that people don't, because one of the points of the novel is that people don't want to be told things they don't already know. They kind of want to be told things they know, but in a safe way. So when going back to Robin Hood, they make Robin Hood and his merry men acceptable to early 21st century consumers. So they don't eat meat, do they?
They don't eat meat, and they are variously abled.
Yes.
And some of the merry men and merry women.
Yes.
Maybe Marian is gay, and therefore chaste.
Yes.
It's because there are a lot of different targets of the novel, I think. Yeah. And some of it is the kind of UKIP tendency, but some else of it is the PC tendency too.
Oh yeah, well it says, you're absolutely right. It does say things about the politics of national identity and the constructed nature of it and how we think about ourselves in certain ways as English. But then there is the kind of stuff about history and memory, more general kind of stuff, which all kind of plays into each other.
The imposing of modern values on the past, which I think is something we're all really guilty of. There is, you know, the huge sort of looking back at people from 20, 30, 40, 50, 200, 300 years ago, and then revisioning what they think and how they acted to have them reflect our own moral certainties.
Oh, yeah. And as someone who has just recently kind of completed a book about the myths of Winston Churchill with two other far more eminent writers, that's what comes across in terms of Winston Churchill. He is made, you know, this racist, the imperialist, blah, 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 is made acceptable to us by, you know, having him shake the hands of a black man on the London Tube in the darkest hour, you know. He would never have done. So yeah, absolutely. And I became painfully aware of what it was saying about people's ignorance. But the interesting thing was also, again, back to Robin Hood, which, like you say, this is kind of it was deliberately chosen, but it becomes kind of an exemplar of wider things in the novel, that Robin Hood and his merry men, or some of them, start to think of themselves as Robin Hood and his merry men. And they start acting as they imagine the real Robin Hood would have acted, and so they go off message. They stop being PC, don't they? And that happens to quite a few of those, like Dr. Johnson. The man really thinks he's Dr. Johnson. So there's. I think the process of mimesis. That might sound very, very, very highfalutin, and I might be saying it wrong. But there's a process in which the falsely remembered kind of past becomes implicated. The people who are acting it but know they're acting it initially, they become it, you know. They the barrier between the made up and the apparently authentic just disappears.
But of course he doesn't become the real Robin Hood. Oh. Because he becomes the myth of Robin Hood.
Yes, because he's the real Robin Hood.
Exactly. So yeah, again, you know, the myth becomes reality, which is, you know, quite interestingly layered. While I was reading it, a lot of what I was thinking about was the opening titles of the first Austin Powers film. Have you seen that?
Then about the 1960s.
Yeah, where it was kind of this total cartoon Carnaby Street.
Yeah.
And the whole of Swinging London looked like that. Yeah. And they all danced. And I was thinking, actually, that in the same ways, that's doing the same thing, where it's kind of laughing at the mythologizing of a particular time, because for most people, the 60s were not like that.
No.
But when we look back at the 60s now, what we think of is either Swinging London or San Francisco Flower Children.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a time when BBC Two was knocking out I Remember And it was all various years, usually in the 1970s, and then I think in the 1980s. And they would get all these comedians who I'd never heard of going, oh, yeah, I remember. And they were talking about clips which they'd only just watched. I remember Chopper. Like the whole of the 1970s was about chopper strikes and miners strikes. And that was it, you know. And so my memory, and I guess many people's memory of the 1970s, is kind of informed by watching programs about the 1970s based on cliche and stereotype. Yeah, based on, you know, someone's idea of what it was about. So it's all chopper bikes, as like I was saying. So, oh, no, it's a novel which kind of reflects on a process in a humorous way. Just like, I mean, Austin Powers is obviously a parody, but many people might, you know, who knows, might take it as reality.
I mean, I think it is interesting that it was written 1 year into Blair.
Yeah.
So what, and we were in this sort of Britpop, Cool Britannia, you know, Britain leading the way moment.
Yeah.
And yet this book is about, and some of that was about looking backwards. So a lot of the kind of the Oasis versus Blur was seen as, you know, Stones versus Beatles too. A lot of the music that came out then was very influenced by 60s music. There was a kind of revocation of the 60s. And in particular, there's a mod culture of the 60s rather than the sort of hippie culture. And I think there was a lot of nostalgia actually built into that Britpop movement. Now, some argue that that was the kind of beginning of this inward-looking movement that we've come to. Now, I would say that most of the artists who are involved in Britpop would refute that wholly, because they are not particularly known for their Brexity views. But I think maybe on the fringes of that, not the people involved who were making the art, but the people who were attracted to a movement where the Union Jack was cool again, there may have been some of those on the edges of that who were attracted to it, not because of the deeper stuff you get, not in an Oasis song, obviously, but a Blur song, maybe, certainly a Gene song, but the kind of, we're great and we can celebrate it again, finally. And I think that may be what triggered this novel so early in this kind of Brexit journey.
I mean, I was struck, you know, reading it, and when you first mentioned it, I thought, well, 1998, hang on a minute, that's New Labour. That's when Tony Blair was saying, I'm a modern kind of guy, you know, I was brought up with colour TV, which is itself now is a very dated idea. That's really modern, colour TV. But also, you know, talked about making Britain a young country, a modern country, that New Labour was about, you know, modernising the Labour Party, but also modernising Britain, you know, making Britain an outward-looking, fully engaged with Europe, you know, heart of Europe, all that kind of stuff. And that's what Blair was saying. But also at the same time, of course, there were limits on how engaged Britain would be under Blair within the EU. You know, we didn't join the euro. Some people would say that was a good idea. But then also, as New Labour presented itself, it was that infamous party election broadcast with the bulldog. Which Peter Mandelson is always associated with. And the party election broadcast, basically the story of it, was there was a slumbering British bulldog that, you know, there were a litany of all the bad things the Tories had done. And he's kind of like comatose. And then there's talk of Tony Blair and the hope and change and New Britain and this. And the dog kind of starts to wake up and then starts sort of charging off into the sunset.
With his doggy bits airbrushed out.
Well, I was going to say that the more superficial commentators focused on the fact that he's had his dangly bits all aired out. But nonetheless, and so thank them.
Why didn't they just get a female dog?
That's an interesting question. But maybe, anyway, never mind. We're going down a rabbit hole. We're going down a rabbit hole.
Bad, bad, bad place to go.
Yeah, it's a very bad place to be. We should ask him, next time I see Peter Mandelson in my Blairite coven, I'll ask him. You know, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there were certain, yeah, you're right. There's certain paradoxes or kind of maybe contradictions, but the ultimate sort of thrust of New Labour was to kind of be, you know, modernity and, you know, go out in the wider world and all of that. And you can say there were question marks about that as an approach, but nonetheless, a young country, a modern country, and it didn't turn out like that. So the question, I guess, is why did we end up being or becoming, because we might end up being the only industry that Britain can have post-Brexit that is at all interesting to talk to anybody, is our past. And in fact, many of the people who are taking us out of the EU are beguiled by a certain kind of comic book idea of the past, at least like 1940, and all the sirens going off at Brexit party meetings, and Whittaker banging on about the Blitz, you know, yeah. And Nigel Farage getting all teary-eyed at Battle of Britain museums. And obviously the Battle of Britain does feature on the islands.
Yes.
They even shoot down a plane by accident. So the politics of it are really interesting. How come we ended up on the verge of becoming this island theme park, but actually not on the Isle of Wight, but the whole of England?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are two things about the politics that are really interesting in the book. One is they actually join the EU. The island joins the EU and leaves behind and by joining the EU enjoys that larger protectorate. So one of the ways in which it ensures that old England can't take it back is by joining the EU and having a bigger bully to say to old England, no, you can't have us.
Although that is an instrumental device, it's not that Sir Jack really wants to be in the EU. It's kind of a way.
Oh, no, he doesn't care about the EU. Yeah, but again, the EU is this bigger place that will protect him. Yeah. And that's how that, and that's not even seen as controversial. Like, there's little discussion of it in the novel.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah. Secondly, I think the now and the modern that they keep talking about in the novel is not how nostalgia has panned out, and I think that may be partly because the people who are nostalgic now, even for the Blair years, are people who aren't younger. There aren't many people younger than me who look back at the Blair years now and say, oh, I wish things could be like that. They want some of it. Of course they want some of it, particularly if you're on the left, particularly if you're pro-European. But if you're on the further left, you don't see any value in it at all, even though, you know, obviously, like anything, it's a curate's egg. And the advances that were made under Blair haven't had structural change, whereas the advances that were made for pre-Blair generations like the boomers, etc., had such structural change, it changed their lives permanently. So I think there are one of the reasons that modernity didn't stick was because it didn't stick for the very people it was supposed to represent. So people who can't buy a house is the big obvious example. You know, boomers own houses, people who aren't don't. Now, that's a simplification, but it's not far off the truth.
Well, as a sort of critique of the Blair years, that's obviously sound. But there is also the question that all of those, I mean, there's like a list, isn't there, about 50 great British moments that Sir Jack gets, and then he selects his own from that and emphasises.
Well, 50 great British things. So things, they're not all moments, but yeah.
And I mean, maybe it's because I've just been, writing this book about the Churchill miss. There are certain events in our past which become mythologized, which become remembered, and others that don't, at least not to the same extent. So there's always this at the back of my mind, you know, writing about Winston Churchill is what, not so much why do people keep banging on about Winston Churchill in all these different ways, but why is there no comparable myth or focus on Clement Attlee? On, you know, Britain standing alone, allegedly, in 1940, you know, and all of that, up against Europe and the Germans and this and that and the other. That's something which apparently resonates and we can't escape and is even depicted on the island in the novel. But Britain makes itself a fairer, more decent society through collective provision. The National Health Service, which, of course, many people do think is a great thing, many, many people, but it hasn't quite, you know, where is Clement Attlee in that moment? There are Labour members who go on about Clement Attlee and they think Clement Attlee is Jeremy Corbyn and Jeremy Corbyn, Clement Attlee and all of that. But that's not comparable in the same way to the Winston Churchill myth. It's not as pervasive. So there are some memories which become more pervasive than others. There's various explanations for that.
I think in some ways you kind of answered your own question in that we do, certainly on the left, and really as a country, we mythologize the NHS. You know, the NHS is our national religion, is something that's said across left and right. Not all the right like it, but it is the case. I would say that in terms of why not Clement Attlee and why Churchill? Churchill was a Tory individual, very interested in being charismatic. Mm. Clement Attlee was none of those things. He was a collectivist, not remotely charismatic, as we know from the play that we saw about him.
And which, of course, we have talked about, on Zeitgeist Hope.
And I think, you know, what we mythologize about Attlee are the achievements. So the NHS, the Open University, the house building. I'm sorry, you're right, it was. I'm thinking of Jenny Lee, who was obviously in the Attlee government, but didn't do it until later. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm a bit historian, sorry.
No, it's fine. You're allowed to tell me when I'm wrong. I just like Jenny Lee and want to talk about her. The achievements that he created, the welfare state, housing, NHS, those things that were the post-war achievements of that five-year government are huge and still with us. But we mythologize the institutions rather than the man.
Right. No, I get that. Although, the play that we saw, what was it called? A Very Modest Man.
Very Modest Man.
Very Modest Man. Actually made quite a lot of his modesty and his taciturnity and turned it into quite a comic thing, and actually you could say a quintessentially, in inverted commas, English thing, whereas Churchill is a bizarre figure, you know, very un-English, in inverted commas again. But anyway, I totally get your point, but there is scope for having Attlee mythologized, but he isn't, not in the same way. But anyway, I don't know if you've got anything more to say about the novel, Emma, but it does raise all kinds of really interesting questions, which may or may not have been Julian Barnes's intention in 1998.
No, he's not a soothsayer. There's no way he could have known what was going to happen. But it did. It crystallised a moment in time where I think we were making a decision we didn't know we were making as a country.
Yeah,
and that set us on the path that we're now on. And I, you know, as a piece of art, it's a brilliantly readable novel. I read it very, very quickly, really, really enjoyed it. It's not easy to read in that it doesn't have bloody chapters. It has three parts and they're really long. So it's not like, you know, when you do that 5 minutes of reading before you go to bed, like there's no obvious breaks for that, but that's my only quibble. Please give me chapters, authors. It's readable, it's fun, it's interesting, and it makes you think. But I think in terms of what we're looking at, I really think that it crystallised for me that this moment has been going on a lot longer than I thought it had.
And I think if anyone is looking to understand how we ended up here, and compared to where did New Labour start, I think it kind of does raise the question that even at the moment of New Labour, you know, the great landslide in 1997 and Tony Blair apparently taking all before him in terms of marching into the future and the third way, even at that moment, there were seeds that would, shall I bother extending that metaphor? There were seeds that would grow into some monstrous plant. I'm abandoning that metaphor. That metaphor is now abandoned. But you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting sort of counterweight to all the lionization of that great moment. So why it all went wrong? Because actually the seeds of why it all went wrong were already there.
Absolutely. And in many ways, the politicizing of Cool Britannia was part of, you know, that was always going to have a dark cousin, you know?
Right.
Brilliant. Well, I would highly recommend it to readers if they haven't already read it and if we haven't completely spoiled it for you.
No, I would definitely recommend it as well. It's an interesting, easy, thought-provoking read. And well done, Julian Barnes, over 20 years after first publishing it. Thumbs up from these two readers.
And thank you to Karen from Primarily 2020 for recommending it.
Yes, thank you very much, Karen. So it now behoves me to just remind the listener that this has been a Political Human production, and to thank Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield for the theme tune. And to remind you, listener, that on whichever platform you happen to be listening to us, can you please rate and review us, and just encourage everybody to just listen to the Zeitgeist tapes.